Hey everyone, you are listening to The Youth Vote, where we explore the different ways young people interact with politics. I'm Isaac Goff Mitchell. On today's show, I spoke with James Coleman, newly elected South San Francisco City Council member. We talked together about local government and how cities can address issues in climate, housing, and public safety. Stay tuned.
My name is James Coleman. I was recently elected to South San Francisco's City Council in the city's District 4. And my election makes me the youngest ever elected, as well as the first openly LGBTQ+, and first openly Democratic Socialist member of the City Council. And we ran a grassroots campaign as an open Democratic Socialist, and we were able to, through the efforts of hundreds of small dollar donors and volunteers, unseat an 18-year incumbent who is also this year's mayor.
Okay, wonderful. So you, the identity that you had going in, so your identity as obviously a young person, your identity as an openly LGBTQ plus person, and your identity as somebody who claims that Democratic Socialist tag, none of that was hidden at any point in the race. Like, you embraced those identities. And I remember I watched your really well done campaign video. It seems like you kind of put some of those identities right at the front, and you said, like, this is who I am and here are the issues I support. Is that the case, that you really owned those aspects of who you are throughout the race?
Yeah, I didn't hide any of that. You know, we ran really an issues focused campaign mostly. I don't want to say that, you know, because identity matters, but only to some extent. And especially with just a label of Democratic Socialist, it really is just a label, but it really is the policies that matter, and the policies are what appeal to people. And so I'd say our campaign was mostly issues focused, and that's why people supported us, because they wanted to see bold change in our city.
And I definitely saw that you had a couple of, like, really bold proposals, and I want to ask you about some of those specific issues. So the first one was, I know the environment was an issue in your campaign, and on this podcast we have a lot of environmental activists come on, or candidates who advocate for the environment. And so my question for you, though, is, what are the specific steps that you plan to take as a city council member to kind of curb some of that environmental damage or make progress in that, like, overarching issue of the environment?
Yeah, I think there are several things we can do. I believe that, you know, in our city, we really haven't done enough to address climate change. It's really been placed in the back burner. Specifically, there have been agenda items that were supposed to be deal with climate, but it just keeps on being thrown into the next meeting and the next meeting and next meeting, because there's other things to talk about. But specifically, you know, banning natural gas in future construction, and beginning the process of phasing out natural gas infrastructure for heating throughout the city, completely banning the use of wood burning fireplaces. Also, you know, electrifying our energy grid, building infrastructure that can accommodate better public transportation, as well as bikers and pedestrians and electrical vehicles, and making sure that, you know, our public transportation is reliable and also covers all parts of the city. Because currently there are a lot of spots where that, you know, public transit just can't reach, or it is unreliable. And that makes it so that, you know, people have to have cars and they have to be driving them to get from point A to point B. That's an unfortunate reality that I would like to change. And beyond the you know, the usual points on electrifying and decarbonizing, we also have to talk about the concept of environmental justice and making sure that no community is left behind when we move towards a greener future. And that means, you know, providing families with air purifiers, and also subsidizing solar panels and, you know, electric heating, so that, you know, your socioeconomic status is not a factor when it comes to transitioning. And that's something that I want to provide, especially because living in California in the Bay Area, we now unfortunately have wildfire seasons that leave the air polluted for weeks at a time. And you know, people's health is really impacted by this. And we need to be putting air purifiers in people's homes if they cannot afford it.
That's interesting you talk about this idea of like purifying the air, because that's an aspect I think that goes widely uncommented on, I guess, where it really does seem like people generally just focus on that electrifying things. And so that environmental justice aspect of things, do you think that that's an issue that spans beyond California, of this idea of environmental justice when it comes to pollution and pollution in the air? Or is that really something that's focused in on the West Coast?
Oh, it's everywhere. You know, it's the communities that are people of color and are low income that are hurt the most when it comes to environmental issues and when it comes to climate change. Like if you look at the Dakota Access Pipeline, it was an oil pipeline that was initially supposed to be routed through a white suburban neighborhood, but of course they got pushback. And then it was routed through Native reservation land. When we look at the case of Flint, Michigan, people there are majority people of color. When we look, you know, around the country, is the low income housing that is always placed next to the waste sites, next to the polluting factories. And you know, this is an issue that subjects a lot of poor people and people of color to pollutants that have lasting health effects. And you can see that, you know, the communities around these waste sites and factories have higher rates of cancer, higher rates of asthma. And so when we address these environmental issues, we have to uplift and you know, provide them with safe housing, more resources, more health resources, and you know, make sure that they aren't left behind, because you know, the government subjected them to this, and now the government has to lift them out of it.
Right. Yeah. And I do want to touch on one more thing in this environmental topic, which is, you mentioned at the very beginning of your answer that there were proposals or conversations being had about the environment, but then they never really saw the light of day, or they were kind of pushed back or ignored. And I wanted to ask you, is part of your ability to really address these issues just the fact that you can force the council to talk about them, or you can make it to where these issues don't just get pushed back and put on the back burner and ignored?
Yeah. I definitely think now that I have a seat at the table, I can definitely do that. Because I think, you know, also part of the reason is COVID was an urgent issue. But I think there's a lack, well, not that there's a lack, but, you know, people need to understand that climate change is also an urgent issue. Because there's this concept of climate lag, where, you know, the emissions that we're putting out today will have its effect 40 years from today. So, you know, it's going to be a lot worse than it is now. And even now we're seeing the effects of intensified hurricanes and storms throughout the world, and in California specifically, intensified wildfires that are really devastating the entire state. And so it very much is an issue of now, but sometimes, you know, people lose the sense of that urgency just because of the nature of the problem.
Right. No, that makes sense. I appreciate you kind of explaining that, because I had never really thought about the idea of just the way that a council member can just kind of make an issue into an important issue, if that makes sense. Like, without your presence, perhaps these issues could be put as less important than something else. And
yeah,
another issue
it also requires the mayor to put it on the agenda. And actually the previous mayor that was kicking the can down the road was Mayor Rich Garbarino, which was my opponent, which I defeated. And so, you know, the incoming mayor, who was last year's vice mayor, will be much more reliable when it comes to putting things like climate change issues on the agenda. I have a good faith in that.
That's good. Yeah, it's good to hear that. And I also wanted to ask you about another issue that you talked about during your campaign, which was the idea that there are rising housing costs in your community, and that you want to address this issue. And the reason why I'm really interested in this is because, so I live in the Midwest, I live in Ohio, and I see that that's an issue here. And I have friends in New York City where that's an issue. And I have friends who live in Texas where that's an issue. So it seems like this nationwide problem where people are being kind of forced out of their communities. And so really my question to you is, what can somebody in local government do to address the issue of rising housing costs so that people aren't forced out of their own community?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the issue of housing affordability is so big, and the root cause of that is because of housing being commodified. I believe that housing is a human right, that people should not live homeless, that everyone should get a house, that the government should provide for, you know, their basic needs, for a basic apartment for them. And unfortunately, there is a large shortage throughout the nation when it comes to public housing, because the federal government has banned the construction of new units of public housing unless they destroy old units, which is terrible. AOC is actually working on repealing that. But you know, when it comes to California, there's so many more laws that come against that. You know, there's Article 34 in California, which means that any public funds that a city uses to build affordable housing has to be voted on basically through a ballot initiative in that city. And that makes it extremely hard, because sometimes your voters will not like that, because, you know, inherently the system, as well as some people, are classist, and they don't want that type of building in their neighborhood, because people, they see themselves and they don't feel like they need that social safety net, because no one looks at themselves and thinks like, okay, maybe down the line I might lose my job, or I might lose my healthcare insurance, or I might be bankrupt because of a health concern, a health issue. And so, you know, there is going to be need for change at the state and national level, but on the local level, we can build more affordable housing through allocating funds and you know, putting it up for vote. And also just want to say that Article 34 is trying to be repealed by State Senator Scott Wiener. Right now, he just introduced legislation to do so. So there definitely is a lot of effort trying to reform that, and hopefully that passes and we can, you know, really get towards doing that. Another issue in California is that the state used to give cities around a few million dollars every year to build affordable housing, but that fund has been taken away. And so now cities are really struggling when it comes to building affordable housing. And so what has happened is that, you know, we build tons of market rate housing, which subsidizes the affordable housing. And, you know, every developer will come in and they'll say, okay, I'll build 85% market rate housing and then 15% affordable. And then, you know, they subsidize each other. But the thing is, 15% is not enough, and people are still hurting. The market rate housing is gentrifying neighborhoods and displacing people, and you know, it's causing a lot of harm. So there really needs to be a lot of change made, and hopefully we can see that in the coming years.
Yeah. So just to kind of like summarize, do you think it really does need to be like a federal, a state, and a local approach to this? There's not one level of government that can really solve this issue alone.
Yeah. I think definitely state, because state and federal place so many limits on it, it has to be done at either of those levels. And because affordable housing can be very expensive for some cities, you know, there would have to be some sort of state or federal funding.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
The last issue I did want to ask you about is something that has been really a recurring theme on this podcast, because it's been such a big issue. And this podcast was created in April. So since the beginning of this podcast to now, this has been kind of on the national forefront, is this idea of public safety. And I know in your campaign, you honed in on talking about public safety. And I saw on your campaign website, you mentioned cutting funds from the police department And I love the way you worded it, where you said, we're a small city, not a war zone. And I wanted just to ask you if you could kind of elaborate on that plan and what you think the impact would be on your community if you are to actually successfully cut that public funding for the police department.
Yeah, so our police department is one of the very few, I think one of only two, in the entire Bay Area that has its own militarized mine resistant vehicle. Why do we have this? we have 700, over $700,000 worth of military equipment. And so, you know, one of the first steps is going to be, we need to demilitarize our police and return all that equipment back to the federal government. Then we really need to take a close look at the police budget and figure out, okay, where's this money being wasted? Because, you know, many community members and also nationally, people are looking at these police budgets and saying, wow, this is really wasteful spending. A lot of this money can be put elsewhere where it can better benefit the community. And so actually this year, when a bunch of community members went to the city council asking for funds to be moved out of the police department, they did the opposite. They literally defunded every other department, Parks and Rec, the fire department, libraries, all across the board. And then they increased the police budget by $150,000. And this was in the midst of their COVID-19 budget cuts. They cut everyone except the police. And the police department, they composed around roughly a third of the entire budget of the city, which comes out to around $31 million around. I think if we take a third of that, let's say a third, then we have $10 million to play with. That can, you know, $7 million can fund universal pre-K. Let's reinstate our city's affordable housing fund that used to get from the state $2 million every year. Let's put it there and let's build some affordable housing. And then we can use the last $1 million just to help everyday people, just for grants here and there, maybe for air purifiers, or universal broadband internet, laying down that fiber broadband that we need so desperately. And you know, just with a third of that budget, we can do so much. And I hope that that's something that we can do in the coming years.
Yeah, and James, I really appreciate you taking that next step that I think sometimes progressives don't take in their messaging, which is, you said, like, we should defund and then we should put that money towards these extra things. Because when you conceptualize it that way, like, it's such a logical argument. Like, if we just cut by this amount, then we can have all of these benefits that help everybody. Universal pre-K helps everybody, and affordable housing and communities helps everybody. Like, the access to these safety net programs are so beneficial. I just really like the way that you kind of elaborated on that and explained that in a way that was really comprehensive and concise as well.
Yeah, thanks. I also think that, you know, like, it's not just, let's take these resources and put it towards it. I think it's also like, okay, $5 million can fund X and $3 million can fund Y, and like, this is possible and let's do it. Because I mean, look at New York's budget, right? New York City's budget, it's like, what, $6 billion, billion? That's kind of crazy. Yeah. You know, you can say $1 billion can feed everyone in New York City, you know, something like that. And that can, it's probably less, by the way, it's nowhere, probably right. Not even $1 billion, probably like $10 million. So like, you know, just saying things like that can make everyone, can open people's eyes and make them think like, oh, we can actually help people and not brutalize them in the streets.
Well, so for just a brief aside then, my question to you, because most of the people who listen to this podcast are either like gonna run for office one day, gonna work for campaigns one day, or going to actively like Twitter support progressives throughout their life. So it's like that kind of progressive wing of young people. Do you think that that's something that young progressives need to start doing, is putting dollar amounts on the policies that they're supporting and really saying like, okay, here's how we fund this and here's where the money comes from and that kind of thing? Because I just, from my perspective, it seems like that's been missing to an extent amongst the conversations that I have with young progressives.
Yeah, I don't think it needs to be like, I think it's good, but it doesn't need to be super specific. Like, you don't have to do like all these calculations. Like, that's what your city staff is there to do. I think, you know, taking the budget of like a similar city that has done universal pre-K and, you know, extrapolating like, okay, population and cost versus population cost, then you can kind of estimate. And that's what we did. I just looked at a couple cities that had universal pre-K. I took the population, divided it, and said that, okay, it's probably gonna cost between $7 to $10 million for a city, maybe less, right? And it really depends, like, okay, do we want to have a universal program where it's free at the cost of service, which I want. That's where I stand. But
yeah, no, thank you for that. And then the last thing I did want to ask you about as we kind of start wrapping up this interview is, so like our target demographic of the show is generally people between like 18 and 29. Like that's like 96% of our listeners the last time I looked at the data for that. And I just know through social media interaction, based on kind of how we target it, most of those people are progressives and definitely in the left-leaning side of politics. And I get the vibe that a lot of young people on the left are pretty anxious about the way that our nation is moving, or they feel a sense of social anxiety towards like kind of the future of our country. So my question to you is kind of, what would you like to say to that audience to kind of address some of those concerns that they might have? Because from my perspective, elections like yours, like when I see a young progressive get elected into office, I go, oh, okay, look, there's hope. So I guess, do you have anything you'd like to kind of cap off this interview with as far as a message to those young people goes?
Yeah, I think a lot of you might be thinking of running for office in the future. I think it's really important to just go out and do it and really prepare for it. I think, you know, beforehand, obviously you want to set up a bit of groundwork and build those connections. So, you know, I think get involved with, you know, maybe your city commissions, with your local organizations, like Sunrise Movement, DSA, you know, whatever organizations are in your area, and start organizing. Because these are the groups that you want to support you. Because you don't want to have, you want to avoid corporate money and the money of real estate and private developers and police unions. And so, you know, if you don't have money, then you're gonna need people. And if you support the policies that will support everyday working people, then run and get their support and run a grassroots campaign. And you know what, like elections, competitive elections are very healthy to a democracy. And so even if you do not win, and hopefully you do win, but if you don't, you'll be starting very necessary discussions and asking questions that otherwise would not be asked or discussed if you were not running. And raising these issues are really important because you're also, you know, building that infrastructure through the many people who will be donating and volunteering for your campaign. And, you know, the connections you're making just by going door to door knocking, or hopefully out of pandemic, or phone calling, right? And through that, if you don't win the first time, run again, and you might win the second time. And you should definitely pursue it.
Awesome. Well, James, thank you so much. And I really appreciate your time that you were able to take out of your day to speak with me about these issues and to kind of share your story. And I hope that all goes well and you're able to get some of this stuff accomplished. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Okay, thank you so much to James for speaking with me today. It was really an honor to speak with him, and I know that I left this conversation knowing a lot more than I knew going into it. Additionally, I wanted to share with you some ways that you can help out the podcast. You can follow us on Twitter or on Instagram at TheYouthVote1. You could also leave a review on Apple or wherever it is that you listen to this podcast. Thank you so much, and tune in next week. You will not want to miss it. The Youth Vote is hosted by me, Isaac Mitchell, produced and edited by Jamie Hobbs, with cover art from Cole Callahan, intro and outro music by Ennio Gallucci, and social media management by Bridget Junker.